Thank you very much, Chris, for those very kind words with which you introduced me. And yes, it's good to be a friend of Chris, even in spite of our differences at times, as he said. But Chris is a man of integrity and very important contributor to the current discussions that are going on in the church at the moment. The general topic of this conference is, of course, about that expression, the final battle. And I'd like to kind of carry on from Father Ilo's talk by giving a little background to the words that he quoted from Cardinal Caffara. Some of you will know this, others not. But it's only a few years ago that Cardinal Caffara recalled how 30 years previously, it was the year 1980, Pope St. John Paul II asked him to begin a new and important initiative, a new institute for studies on marriage and the family at the Pontifical Lateran University in Rome. He was then just Monsignor Caffara. And he kept quiet about this for 30 years. I think it was about 4 or 5 years ago he made this public. He said, "When the Holy Father asked me to begin this new initiative, I wrote to Sister Lucy, Seer of Fatima, simply asking for her prayers for this new initiative. I didn't expect any answer," he said, "because, as we all know, Sister Lucy was under very, very strict obedience as to who she could talk to or write to." So he said, "I was delighted and surprised to receive back from Sister Lucy, in her own writing and signed, an answer to my request. Not only would she pray for its success, but she said the words that Father Ilo quoted were actually from Sister Lucy's letter, that marriage and the family are fundamental at this time. The final battle will be about this. But Our Lady has crushed the head of the serpent and she will eventually triumph." So whether we're at the moment at the final moments of this great battle, we are certainly at a very, very critical point. Right now, end of February 2016, going into March, when we're expecting a new document to follow up the recent Synod of Bishops. Now, there's two fundamentally important points that have been called into question recently from the very highest levels of the church's hierarchy. First of all, is the teaching that divorced and civilly remarried Catholics who are in a relationship of intimacy that our Lord himself calls adultery may not receive Holy Communion. The second one, and we've heard about this a great deal probably in the last week or so because of Pope Francis' remarks on the plane trip back from Mexico to Rome, the bimillennial teaching of the Church that it's intrinsically evil and therefore never justifiable for spouses to deprive the conjugal act of its procreative power, what's commonly called contraception. Now, in my talk this morning, I want to touch on both of these very critical issues which have become very much in the news just recently, just in the last 4 months since the end of the October Synod on the Family, and now just last week with a new tremendous controversy arising over the Pope's comments regarding contraception. Let's talk first about the Communion for Divorced and Remarried issue. As is well known, the standard bearer for opposition to the doctrine of the Church, the doctrine and practice of the Church of not allowing divorced and civilly remarried couples to communion without a decree of nullity and without a special commitment to live as brother and sister. We know these possible exceptions, but the nuances. But basically, this has been the teaching of the Church for 2,000 years. And the opposition to this has become popularly known as the Casper Proposal. Cardinal Walter Casper has been the point man, let's say, for this during the Synod, before the Synod. But let's be very frank here. It was Pope Francis himself who opened up this topic for discussion by allowing it to come onto the agenda for both the 2014 and the 2015 Synod. And in various ways, the Holy Father has indicated, without actually spelling it out, his personal support for Cardinal Kasper's proposal. Now, both 2014 and 2015 synods, in their final relazione, the relatio just means report in Latin, they didn't authorize communion for divorced and remarried, but they did leave what looked like a loophole. They said in both of the reports, in paragraphs that only barely got the, in fact, in the 2014 synod, one of these didn't get the required two-thirds majority of votes, but they said that the people living in this situation are objectively in violation of God's law regarding the indissolubility of marriage. But they added a comment saying, well, the subjective imputability may perhaps be diminished by certain factors. Now, the implication was that, well, maybe these subjective factors, diminishing the personal responsibility, might open a pathway for these people, or some of them, to be given Holy Communion officially. I say officially because unofficially it's been going on all over, particularly in Western Europe and in this country too, in many places throughout the world. Divorced and remarried people have been approaching communion and without any official permission from the church, but this is what they're looking for, an official, formal permission for some people who our Lord himself says are committing adultery to receive Holy Communion. Now, this subjective imputability, those of you who read the Latin Mass magazine, a lot of you may have seen my own article in the summer issue of last year, in which I have rebutted Cardinal Kasper's proposal, specifically on this issue of subjective imputability. As we all know from our catechism, to be in mortal sin, there are three conditions. It has to be grave matter. It can't be just a trivial thing. It has to be something in itself, really, a kind of action that is gravely against God's law. There has to be full knowledge of the sinfulness of that act on the part of the person doing it. And there has to be full free consent to carrying out that action. I think all of us have remember that from our catechism. And in my Latin Mass magazine article, I focused on these two subjective conditions for mortal sin, full knowledge and full free consent. And I concluded that if you take into consideration all of the factors in this situation, neither of those subjective conditions would apply. And that therefore, this supposed avenue for opening up a justification for admitting some people in this situation to Holy Communion was not, it was unsustainable. And but now the thing I want to get to in my talk this morning, at the time I wrote that article for the Latin Mass, in fact it was a talk that I'd given earlier in St. Louis, and an adaptation of that talk, it was published in the Latin Mass, but at the time I wrote that, I was not aware of another very important magisterial document which bears directly on this question. It's a very little known document, and my attention was drawn to it 4 months ago when I had the honour of being able to talk to Cardinal Burke over in Italy for a while, and he said that the Synod Final Relatio made a brief reference to this document, which I'm going to talk about, but it was very manipulative, it was very misleading. Well, I went back and looked it up on the Vatican website, and I found, saw just how right Cardinal Burke was. I'm referring to a document published in the year 2000, 24th of June 2000, by the Pontifical Council for Legislative Texts. I'll just call that the Pontifical Council in what follows to make it a little bit shorter. It issued a document of the utmost relevance to this controversy we're talking about. It's a declaration, the title of the document is a declaration concerning the admission to Holy Communion of faithful who are divorced and remarried, spot on the exact topic of what this controversy has been about, and it's hardly anybody knows about this document. There's no Latin text of this document. The original was in Italian. Now, its main purpose was to rebut and disallow a false interpretation of Canon 915 of the Code of Canon Law. This canon states, and I quote, "Those upon whom the penalty of excommunication or interdict has been imposed or declared, and others who persist in manifest grave sin, are not to be admitted to Holy Communion." End of quote. Now, that canon, 15, 20 years ago, was being falsely interpreted by progressive, quote-unquote, canonists and theologians who were promoting an idea that's become much more notorious now with the 2014 and 2015 synods. They were arguing that particular phrase within that canon 915, the words, "others who persist in manifest grave sin," the liberals were arguing that these words should not be taken to include divorced and civilly remarried Catholics, because even though their relationship is objectively gravely sinful, our Lord calls it adultery, their subjective imputability, is that theme coming back again, at the level of their own conscience, might be diminished or mitigated for one reason or another. Therefore, according to these liberal canonists and theologians, the priest or other minister of communion should always give such folks communion if they come up for it at Mass, because he would be incompetent to make any judgment about the private state of their conscience. The priest should give them the benefit of that doubt, so it was said, even when he knows that they are not validly married in the sight of God and the Church. Now, the 2015 Relatio cites this Pontifical Council document, but does so in a very misleading way. Here's the relevant passage in Article 85 of the 2015 Synod Relatio. "It cannot be denied that in some circumstances, the imputability and responsibility for an action can be diminished or annulled." And there's a quote from the Catechism of the Catholic Church to that effect there. In itself, that's true. "Due to psychological conditions. Consequently, the judgment on an objective situation should not lead to a judgment about subjective imputability." And the words "subjective imputability" in the Relatio are in quotation marks, quoting this year 2000 Pontifical Council for Legislative Texts declaration. Just two words placed in quotation marks. Subjective imputability. Now, section 2A of the Pontifical Council declaration does indeed imply the observation attributed to it by the Relatio. In other words, that from the simple fact that someone is doing something that's objectively sinful, we can't conclude without further ado that that person is necessarily subjectively imputable, because it might be they don't have full knowledge or they don't have full consent. Okay, so if that's true, why do I say that the citation of the declaration by the Synod is very misleading? Because it is highly selective and taken out of context. It conspicuously fails to tell readers the reason why the Pontifical Council found it necessary to raise this question at all of diminished subjective imputability. It did so only in the context of rejecting totally this claim of liberal Catholics that because priests and other ministers of communion can't judge the inner conscience of the people out there in the pews coming up for communion, that such folks should be given communion whenever they come forward for it at Mass. Now, this becomes clear as soon as we look at the original context that those two little words, subjective imputability, that were cited by the Synod's final relatio. The Pontifical Council is here handing down an official, authentic interpretation of the words grave sin in that Canon 915 of the Code of Canon Law. And the official interpretation is this. It says, this term, grave sin, is to be understood objectively, because the minister of communion would not be able to make a judgment regarding subjective imputability. In other words, the Church has ruled here in this document that provided the other conditions mentioned in Canon 915 for refusing communion are also present, as they would be in the case we're considering, sacramental ministers, priests, deacons or others, must refuse communion to civilly remarried divorcees because of the objective gravity of their sin, irrespective of whether or not it is subjectively imputable before God in the private forum of their conscience. In other words, the Church has ruled here, it doesn't matter if they're subjectively innocent, maybe not with full knowledge, maybe not with full free consent. Doesn't matter. They have to be refused communion anyway. Well, now why? Isn't this a bit harsh? We can see now that the prelates responsible for drafting the 2015 final relatio not only failed to give the other synod fathers any indication that this pontifical council declaration thereby delivers a knockout blow to the Casper proposal, they manipulated the declaration in such a way as to make it gently insinuate support for the Casper proposal. For their selective quotation hints, more by way of what it omits than by what it cites, that diminished subjective imputability just might open a possible path to communion for some civilly remarried divorcees, when the whole purpose of that document was exactly the opposite. Now, the Pontifical Council's reasoning here is that since the marital status of civilly remarried divorcees is a matter of public knowledge, unlike, say, a couple's use of contraceptives or a man's furtive nocturnal visit to a gay bathhouse that nobody knows about. No, those who are civilly divorced and remarried are in a state recognized by law that is public knowledge. And so the Pontifical Council says, this is why they must be refused communion, even if perhaps they are subjectively innocent and blameless in their own conscience, because admitting them would cause great scandal. That's the difference. A public state of objective sin has to take into account the very important factor of scandal being given. Nobody knows you've committed a mortal sin, no scandal's given, you go up to communion, right? But if you're living in a public state that the Church, that our Lord himself says is adulterous, you go up for communion, the Church said, that's fine, you can receive communion. This is giving scandal in the theological sense of that word. Often we use the word scandal today, mean, well, a source of gossip, you know, scandal, latest love affairs of Hollywood movie stars or whatever. No. Scandal in Catholic vocabulary means causing other people to sin, giving an occasion for sin to other people. Moreover, as the declaration goes on to point out, this is the Pontifical Council declaration, this kind of interpretation of Canon 915, which is saying, oh, you give it to everybody because they might be subjectively innocent and blameless, you see, in their own conscience. They say this would in effect empty the words of the canon of their substance, because it would logically apply to all other Catholics living in publicly sinful situations. Since only God knows for sure the subjective state of other people's consciences, admitting remarried divorcees to communion on a subjectivist benefit of the doubt basis would imply showing the same false quote-unquote mercy to cohabiting couples, homosexual couples, polygamists, polyamorists, mafia dons, virtually any other public sinners who choose to call themselves Catholic. So the Pontifical Council pointed out, you admit that kind of exception, you're going to be left with a canon that hasn't, nobody's going to fall under that prescription, because everybody, you know, might be, for all we know, subjectively innocent in their own conscience. And if you're going to say that even if it's a public thing they're doing contrary to God's law, they can still come up to communion, then you're going to be causing scandal all over the place, and you're emptying this canon of its fundamental meaning. So, since the relevant words of Canon 915 would thus end up applying to nobody at all, the Pontifical Council points out that this permissive interpretation makes the canon absurd and therefore incorrect. Now, the liberal-leaning majority in the commission that drafted the 2015 Synod's Relatio probably realised that they could scarcely ignore altogether this important 2000 declaration of the Pontifical Council. It was so uncongenial to their own more, quote-unquote, merciful aspirations. So they apparently decided to give it a nod, quoting it selectively and misleadingly, and hoping nobody would notice. In fact, the Synod Fathers had to vote very hurriedly at the last minute on each of the final Relatio's 94 paragraphs. All of them were read out in Italian with simultaneous off-the-cuff translations, only a few hours before the Synod was scheduled to end. The earlier draft of the final Relatio was so skewed and biased with liberal insinuations that a lot of the Synod Fathers objected, said, "This is no, this is absolutely unacceptable." But at the last minute, they had to scramble around composing a more moderate, let's say, document. And they were left on the Saturday morning, 24th of October. Synod was due to end in the afternoon of that same day. And so the Fathers certainly had no opportunity to look up this little-known Pontifical Council declaration and find out for themselves what it actually said. To put it bluntly, they were deceived into supposing this little-known but very important Vatican declaration does not rule out a change in sacramental discipline, that in fact it does rule out, totally, explicitly, and unambiguously. Moreover, this 2000 declaration not only asserts the impossibility, quote-unquote, of communion for civilly remarried divorcees, section 5, it also makes the extremely important assertion that this prohibition, found in this canon 915, and I'm quoting here the declaration, this is by its nature derived from divine law and transcends the domain of positive ecclesiastical laws. The latter cannot introduce legislative changes which would oppose the doctrine of the Church, unquote. And precisely because divine law is at stake here, that no earthly authority can change, the document insists that no exceptions can be made to this prohibition of communion for civilly remarried divorcees. It says, and here again I quote number one of the declaration, bearing in mind the nature of the above-cited norm, that's citing number one, no ecclesiastical authority may dispense the minister of communion from his obligation in any case, nor may he issue directives that contradict it. End of quote. That's from section 4. If the Synod Fathers had been more fully and accurately informed about the content of this Pontifical Council declaration, it seems certain that paragraph 85, that's the relevant one that dealt with this issue, that paragraph 85, which only barely managed to garner the required two-thirds majority of votes, would have failed to reach that level of acceptance. No? If the Synod Fathers had known that this document is absolutely ruling out any supposed subjective imputability as a possible grounds for giving communion to the civilly remarried divorcees, certainly it would not have got that two-thirds majority of votes. And so the most ambiguous and objectionable paragraph of the Relatio would thus have been rightly relegated to the dustbin. At a time when not a few bishops, cardinals, and theologians are confidently assuring us that a change in the bimillennial discipline in question would leave the Church's doctrine supposedly fully intact, it seems very important that all Catholics become aware that the Church has already firmly rejected that idea. To sum up this part of my talk, in the year 2000, the Church declared the exclusion of civilly remarried divorcees from communion to be a consequence of divine law, so that any supposedly merciful mitigation of the discipline, and I quote them again, would oppose the doctrine of the Church. End of quote. We must hope and pray fervently that His Holiness Pope Francis, in preparing his post-synodal apostolic exhortation, becomes, if he's not already, fully cognizant of this fact and of exactly what that earlier declaration of the Church said. Now, I was intending originally just to limit my talk to that topic, but just in the last week or so, as I think all of us are aware, another extremely important issue has come up because of what Pope Francis said in his remarks on the plane journey from Mexico back to Rome regarding contraception. Let's listen to what he was saying. As you probably remember, he told journalists that he was asked by a journalist whether couples infected with the Zika virus, which it seems there's strong probability that can sometimes cause lead to the birth of seriously deformed babies with microcephalous infants, and in these like emergency or really hard cases, would the Church consider allowing couples to use either abortion or contraception in that situation? Well, the Pope came right out and said, well, abortion, absolutely no, that's intrinsically evil. But he said, well, lesser of two evils, it's not always a sin to avoid pregnancy, and possibly in this emergency or extraordinary situation, there might be a case for allowing the use of contraceptives after due discernment. Now, that was confirmed by the Vatican press spokesman, Father Federico Lombardi, the next day, and probably most of you have seen this. If there was any ambiguity in the Pope's statement on the plane, Father Lombardi made it very clear that, yes, the Pope was saying that in certain emergency or extraordinary situations, it might be okay for the couple to, after due discernment and prayer, to use contraceptives in order to avoid the birth of these possibly seriously deformed babies. Now, the Holy Father also said that he's on the plane, this was already, and Father Lombardi confirmed this the next day. The Holy Father also said that his predecessor Paul VI had already 50 years previously allowed nuns in the Congo who were in danger of rape during the civil war there to use contraceptives. So he was basing his answer to the journalist on this supposed precedent. Now we have to remember that this, of course, was a spontaneous, unprepared answer on the part of Pope Francis. Unfortunately, it does not accurately express the Church's teaching on contraception. I think all well-educated Catholics know that popes enjoy the gift of infallibility. They're guaranteed to be right only in very exceptional, carefully worded, formal documents. And when speaking off the cuff to journalists, certainly, as the present Holy Father often does, popes can make mistakes just like the rest of us. Well, now, there's several points that need to be clarified here. Three points that I'd like to try to clarify. First of all, did Pope Paul really authorize those nuns to use contraceptives? Subsequent investigation, some of you might have seen Father Z's blog, he went right into that in great detail. It looks as though, in fact, there is no record of this permission ever being given by Pope Paul VI or anybody in the Vatican at that time. A friend of mine, Bishop Peter Elliott, who was a consultant for the Pontifical Council for the Family, he's the Auxiliary Bishop of Melbourne, Australia, and he was in Rome during the 80s when this, he said, he chased down every avenue he could to try to trace down or track down this supposed permission given to these nuns in the Congo. Nothing, came up with a complete blank. So there was certainly never any document officially authorized. Who knows, maybe a private phone call from someone in the Vatican to the Mother Superior. We don't know, but in any case, there's no evidence at all that this permission was ever actually given. However, it's the second point that needs clarification. Supposing such permission had been given, would that have contradicted the doctrine of the Church? Well, now, first of all, we need to distinguish between what sort of contraceptives we're talking about. If it was the pill, now, any authorization to use the contraceptive pill to avoid conception, even taken by a nun in danger of rape, it would have contradicted the doctrine of the Church precisely because the pill can act as an abortifacient. We don't know how often it does, but it does at times act that way. And anything which provokes an abortion, of course, is certainly morally unacceptable. Although back in the early 1960s, to be fair, if somebody did make a phone call from the Vatican authorizing the pill for those nuns, which we don't know, it may be that back at that time, the pill was still in its infancy at that stage. It might not have been known back then that it can act as an abortifacient. In other words, preventing the implantation of the already fertilized zygote. But suppose it was not the pill that was authorized. Suppose it was the insertion of an IUD, intrauterine device, or a diaphragm, a device that would simply physically block the passage of a rapist's seminal fluid, prevent it from passing to the point where it might unite with the ovum and cause conception. Supposing that permission had been given, would that kind of authorization of a purely, physical barrier method in anticipation of a real danger of possible rape, would that have contradicted the Church's teaching? Now, the answer I'm going to give might surprise some of you, because the answer is no, it would not have contradicted Catholic doctrine. It would, in fact, be in line with Church teaching. And if we look at the wording of Humanae Vitae, before that, Pope Pius XI's teaching in Casti Connubi, there'd be nothing in those documents, and in the traditional teaching of the Church, that would forbid, morally, the use of that kind of barrier contraceptive by a nun or any other sexually inactive woman who's in serious danger of rape to use such a device. Now, I'll say a little bit more about that. Why? In fact, well before Vatican II, before there was any pill or any talk about nuns in the Congo, many or most approved moral theologians argued that kind of practice simply amounts to preventing the invasion of the woman's reproductive area prior to conception by an unwanted foreign substance, namely the semen of the rapist. Such an act does not constitute the sin of contraception. It does not constitute the sin of contraception. An example of pre-Vatican II moral theology that I have readily at hand in my shelves at home in St. Louis is that the Manual of Moral Theology of the Capuchin priests Heribert Jorne and Urban Adelman. This was so warmly and widely approved for seminary use throughout the world that it went through 17 editions from 1929 to 1958. It was translated from the original German into seven other languages. On page 541 of the 1958 English version, Jorne and Adelman state that while in mutually voluntary intercourse, and I quote them, a woman sins gravely by expelling the seminal fluid or preventing its entry into the uterus, it is not sinful to do so if she has been the victim of rape, provided she does so before conception, since in this instance the semen is equivalent to an unjust aggressor. End of quote. Now, if we read Articles 12 and 13 of Humanae Vitae, where Blessed Pope Paul VI explains the reasons why contraceptive conjugal intercourse is intrinsically immoral, we'll see that these reasons that the Pope gives simply do not apply to the hypothetical nun in question. Simply put, this is an occasion to clarify why does the Church teach that conjugal contraception is wrong. The sin of contraception consists in deliberately depriving one's own voluntary sexual act of its procreative power. That is, perversely grasping at the gratification, the pleasure, while suppressing its most important result, a new human being made in the image and likeness of God. But a woman who is raped does not voluntarily commit any sexual act at all, much less a perverse or abusive one. Therefore, she cannot be guilty of the sin condemned by Paul VI and all the other popes who have spoken magisterially on this matter. And again, I suggest reading Articles 12 and 13, and again in Pius XI, Casti Canubi. It's very clear that he's, but what's intrinsically evil is conjugal intercourse, voluntary intercourse between husband and wife, in which the act is perverted or abused by suppressing the procreative aspect. It's what Pope Paul used the terminology of separating the unitive and procreative aspects of the conjugal act. In the case of someone who's being raped, there is no unitive there at all. It's just simply she's the victim of an aggression. Now, so that's the, to clarify that point there, summing up the first two points I'm making here. First, there's no evidence that Paul VI or anybody in the Vatican ever gave such a permission. Number two, even if it had been given, at least prescinding from the pill, but if it was just a question of some purely barrier method that stops the semen from passing to where it might produce a conception, that would not have been in any case contrary to the teaching of the Church. Now the third point, I'm afraid, is the most delicate one, because this is the fact that Pope Francis has said quite explicitly, and it's been clarified by his own press spokesman, that contraceptives can be used by spouses if after due discernment in an what he calls extraordinary or emergency case, and the example is if someone has this Zika virus, that contraceptives could be justified. And unfortunately, the Pope cited this supposed precedent allegedly set by Pope Paul VI as a justification for what he was saying about the Zika virus. And from what I've said so far, I hope it's very clear, there are two radically different, ethically quite different situations. And even if the Pope had given that permission, it would in no way be a precedent for allowing the use of contraceptives to spouses, one of or both of whom might be infected by the Zika virus, or for that matter HIV or any other problematical medical condition, because the words intrinsically evil, you know, that they speak for themselves, means no exceptions, period. And both Pope Pius XI and Pope Paul VI made that abundantly clear, that what they're saying is sinful is intrinsically sinful. Not even for the gravest reasons can the use of contraceptives be justified. I can just quote a little bit from both of those encyclicals here. Pope Pius XI said, this is his encyclical of the year 1931, Article 54 of Casti Connubii, I quote, "No reason, however grave, may be put forward by which anything intrinsically against nature may become conformable to nature and morally good. Since, therefore, the conjugal act," notice he doesn't say just any kind of, "the conjugal act between husband and wife is destined primarily by nature for the begetting of children, those who in exercising it deliberately frustrate its natural power and purpose, sin against nature and commit a deed which is shameful and intrinsically vicious," end of quote. And Humanae Vitae number 14, Pope Paul VI declared, similarly excluded, after mentioning abortion, sterilization, similarly excluded, and he said absolutely excluded, by the way, further up, so that word is understood here too, absolutely excluded, "is any action which either before, at the moment of, or after sexual intercourse is specifically intended to prevent procreation, whether as an end or as a means," end of quote. Some people have made the point that, well, Pope Paul didn't spell out that it was a mortal sin. Maybe it's only a venial sin now. Well, that's really so weak. You don't change church teaching by just failing to restate. In any case, take note of this. In Article 25, the Pope implies, he doesn't spell it out, but he implies that it's a mortal sin because, let me read you the same words here. Article 25. First of all, he says, "We don't want to pass over in silence the difficulties at times very great which beset the lives of Christian married couples." He says, for them, as indeed for every one of us, he quotes the gospel, "The gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life." And of course, the Lord's talking about eternal life. The implication here is sometimes it may require heroic discipline and sacrifice to do what's necessary for salvation, which implies that it's a mortal sin if you violate that. And further on in the same Article 25, he says, encouraging married couples who are finding great difficulty in this, he realizes it will be very difficult for some. He says, "If, however, sin still exercises its hold over them, they are not to lose heart. Rather, they must humbly and perseveringly have recourse to the mercy of God abundantly bestowed in the sacrament of penance," end of quote. Now, that's a clear indication that, you know, if you need the sacrament of penance when you really need it, that's when it's a mortal sin. And it's pretty clear that he's implying that. So the idea that Pope Paul VI reduced it to a venial sin, that really doesn't wash at all. So we are in a situation now that's very grave because the Holy Father, using a false supposed precedent dating from the time of Paul VI, which was never given, and even if it had been given, it wouldn't have been a precedent for the contraceptives in the case of the Zika virus. Unfortunately, this is already having repercussions around the world. Some of you may have seen just a few days ago that the president of the Filipino Bishops Conference, Archbishop Socrates Villegas, commented as follows, and I quote him, "The Pope has usefully called attention to two important moral precepts. First, there may be circumstances that invite a re-evaluation of the judgment on artificial means of contraception. Second, the prodding of conscience should always be heeded as long as every effort is made to form conscience properly." Now, this is a whole Episcopal conference coming out saying, well, now the Pope has spoken, we can re-evaluate the Church's judgment against artificial means of contraception on the basis of comments on a plane trip and a second-hand report from a Vatican press secretary. We have a whole Episcopal conference now coming out saying, well, now, you know, how many thousands or millions of Filipino Catholics in other countries are now going, hey, it's okay, now we can use the pill, no problem. This is a terribly grave situation. Now, I'd like to conclude my talk. Time for a few minutes of questions. I'd like to conclude my talk by suggesting that, particularly in view of the Filipino bishop's statement, I'd like to suggest that everyone here write a letter to the President of the United States Episcopal Conference, it's Bishop Kurtz of Louisville, right? And Louisville, Kentucky. Write a letter to the President of the U.S. Episcopal Conference pleading, say, please, may the U.S. Bishop Conference come out with a clear statement reaffirming the teaching of the Church in Humanae Vitae, that the use of contraceptives is intrinsically evil, can't be justified for any, no matter how grave the situation. It is simply morally unacceptable. Please reaffirm this teaching for the Catholics of America. I'm going to write, and I would like to suggest that every one of you here today write something similar. There's a whole lot of letters going to the Episcopal Conference saying, please reaffirm the teaching of the Church on this. It might have some effect because we are in a very critical situation now that this question mark has been placed over a fundamental moral teaching of the Church. I spoke to Mr. Walsh about this before the talk and suggested that I could, you know, write up a little, just a brief sort of model type letter that could be sent, and of course everyone would be free to adapt it the way they want to, and that can be sent around emailed or sent to all of you at this conference. We have your address, and you can. We certainly urge you to consider writing something to the US bishops, because I think it really calls for something like this. Thank you very much. It's a good question for those who that we're recording this. The question is, what about the use of contraceptives for those who are not spouses and who are not in danger of rape, but simply those committing fornication or adultery? Now, that's a pretty complicated question. The present state of the question, as I understand, is that there has been a dispute in recent decades among Orthodox moral theologians as to whether the use of contraceptives in fornication or adultery aggravates what's already it's already sinful, period. I mean, for practical pastoral purposes, it's wrong, period, because it's outside of marriage. But the question remains, does it add a new extra sin to fornication or adultery to use a contraceptive of that, or doesn't it make any difference? Some theologians say, really, it doesn't make any difference. Once it's outside marriage, the use of a contraceptive really doesn't make any difference. I myself hold the opinion that it does make a difference, that it's still an act against nature, an act against human life, which actually aggravates the sinfulness of the act of fornication or adultery. But so far, the magisterium has not passed judgment on that. It's a secondary question. I'm not saying it's not important, but certainly the most burning question is, you know, married couples, can they use contraceptives or not? And the question of whether it aggravates an act of fornication or adultery, at the moment, that discussion is left open amongst theologians. By the magisterium has so far said nothing one way or the other about that.
Now, just a follow up, sorry. But the magisterium does specifically say that the use of condoms within the homosexual community is prohibited because of the nature of the condoms. I mean, they come out as evidence from the
Where is that? I'm not aware of that statement. Okay, well, you have to look. I'm kind of doubtful about it, because the thing is that an act between homosexuals is already intrinsically sterile anyway.
Yes.
And whether one ejaculates into part of the body or into a condom, I don't see myself makes a whole lot of difference. I have very much. I very much doubt that the Vatican has said that it's that makes a difference.
Okay.
But I would have to look at that. Another question, yes.
Father, in the case of the one child, two child policy in China for Catholics living in China, is there an opinion on this? You know, for them, what they.
You mean, is it right for the government to pass that kind of law, or what?
Well, they have a limitation on children. You know, for one or two children. I think they've relaxed it to two children, but beyond that, it would be forced abortion, forced sterilization. Would they be justified?
They wouldn't be. Certainly, abortion, absolutely not, even though there's forced abortions in China in some of these cases. But as regards using contraceptives to avoid having the third or second or the third child or whatever, if it's intrinsically evil, it's intrinsically evil. Their only options are morally to use natural family planning or abstinence to avoid the extra child, or have the extra child and face the consequences from the government. But, you know, not even for the gravest circumstances, quote-unquote, means exactly that. You know, you can't make... And of course, you're talking about the Zika virus. The permission that Pope Francis is envisaging for people with that virus, I would say we could qualify this as a doctrinal virus. Because once it's in there, that has tremendous logical implications for all kinds of other things. And it's interesting that I was recently reading, back in 1930, the Anglican Church became the first Christian group in history, as probably a lot of you know, to allow contraceptives in so-called very exceptional hard circumstances, which is exactly what Pope Francis has been saying the other day. And I was reading a very interesting critique of that by another Anglican bishop who was in the minority, Bishop Charles Gore of Oxford, wrote a devastating commentary on what his colleagues, the other Anglican bishops, the majority of them, had voted in favor of contraceptives, reversing their own decision of just 10 years earlier, 1920. And he said, prophetically, this is going to open up the way for all kinds of others. And of course, we've seen that in the last nearly 90 years since the Anglican Communion gave that permission. And we're faced with, we're at the crossroads. This has to be absolutely dealt with it. This is a very critical situation, undermining a very important part of the church's moral teaching. Sorry, yes, sir, do.
I'm concerned about putting so much weight on whether or not someone is able to publicly engage or produce a scandal simply by the fact of whether or not they are civilly married, since this is actually, in practice, not generally known. Unless it's looked up. And it seems to me that virtually any person, if it's emphasized that that's different than any other habitual grave matter, mortal sin situation, but because it's a matter of personal conscience, people are nonetheless sanitized for reception of communion because it's not somehow in a
Nobody is saying that they're somehow sanitized and are okay to receive Holy Communion if it's in a private state. Because if it's something purely private, then the priest or whoever's giving Holy Communion is not going to know about it. The whole point is that it's not that they have permission, the church allows them to come to communion if it's a merely private mortal sin. No, of course not. They are still obliged to abstain from communion.
But I'm hearing between the lines the implication that these are conscience matters, and so it is all right, in some sense, for some people. They just don't know any better. And that we shouldn't...
We say well-formed.
No.
It's well-formed conscience.
No, I'm certainly not saying that if they feel in conscience they can go to communion... They can go if it's just private. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying there's a difference between whether I have a right to go to Holy Communion or not. There's a difference with and whether the priest or the minister can or should refuse them Holy Communion. There's this, the input and the output end there that comes in.
It just seems to me if they would simply say no one who is in an objective state of mortal sin should be permitted to receive communion. That's our policy.
They are. That's the official teaching of the Church. The Church does not give anybody permission to say, you know, you have the right in conscience to dissent from the clear teaching of the Church. There's plenty of false teaching going around to that effect. That is certainly not the position of the Church, to say that if you feel in conscience that you can take contraceptives, then go ahead. No, the Church, it's another sin of pride to for what you know is the teaching of the Church on an important moral issue. It's another sin of pride to say, well, I know better than, I call myself Catholic, but I know better than the Church on this. I know better than the person, the Pope, who's been promised a guarantee by Jesus Christ, you know, to bind and loose, and he'll be guaranteed to be protected from error by heaven. It's an additional sin of pride. It's not really a clear conscience at all. But in any case, the Church certainly doesn't say that if you feel in conscience that it's okay for you to take the pill privately or whatever, then go ahead, you can. No. That's a false teaching by a lot of liberal theologians and so on, but it's not the teaching of the Church about conscience.
Time for one more quick one.
Yes.
I have a quick question. So you talked about people who were divorced and then remarried.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm from a small town, and everybody in my church knows whether you're married or divorced,
right,
or whether you're, most people who are outwardly gay and homosexual or living together have adopted children, haven't. So my question is, what is the Church's teachings or rules on this? I'm divorced. I have four kids. I was married in a Catholic church. I might cry. I'm sorry, but I just don't understand this. I'm not in a relationship with anyone. Mm-hmm. I don't. My husband left my marriage.
Right.
So can I get communion? I don't live with a man. I'm not
yes.
in a relationship with a man. No one is yes. living in my house.
Yes, you're certainly.
Am I allowed to get communion?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay,
yes.
I was getting a little worried.
No. No, the thing is, divorce itself is not the divorce and remarriage. That's what our Lord says. He who puts away his wife and marries another commits adultery. So no problem.
So it's okay. Yeah.
Maybe I could devote